Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor at Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois, and I'm back for episode number 423 of Christ the Center. I had to look at my notes there. We have with us once again Dr. Lane Tipton, who teaches his systematic theology and biblical theology at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Lane. It's good to have you on for another Voss Group.
Thanks, Camden. It's always great to be here.
Yeah, we got a good one lined up. Today we're going to be looking at Voss's Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments, turning to page 119 and looking at the Passover. We're going to get through just a couple pages, probably up to 121, but the reason for that will become apparent as we're going to bring in some other material and expanding on and looking at the function and the nature of the Passover in the Mosaic economy. But before we begin with that, got a couple announcements and things to mention. First, of course, you can visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. We've been sending out year-end reports from 2015 giving season, and my wife's been working dutifully at that. I'm very thankful for that, but most of all, thankful for all of the generous support from all of our listeners from around the world, really, and helping us to produce and distribute all of our programs. We very much appreciate, especially the continued support and the monthly gifts. And there's so many dedicated people that obviously have found benefit of what we're doing, and we're very encouraged by that and love seeing the support each and every month, but also not just financially, receiving that in terms of notes and comments and in conversation. So I want to thank all the listeners for that. If I could, I would like to meet with every single person, but just economies of scale, that's not always possible, and people are in different places of the country or even of the world. Although, we do want to mention that we're going to attempt some more events this spring, and we don't have anything locked down for certain, but we are getting very close to locking in a conference in Austin, Texas. I'll say that much, and I'll say that the date we're looking at very closely is April 30th, 2016. So more information to come on that as we look at details and try to finalize things. But we're looking at hosting a Reformed Forum conference April 30th, 2016 in Austin, Texas, or thereby in nearby Austin in Pflugerville, Texas. Lane, you used to live in Austin, is that correct?
The first year of our marriage, Char and I lived there, 1993, and then we moved to Westminster, California, Escondido, the year after. Yeah, yeah.
How'd you end up in Austin then?
Well, I was wanting to go study Western philosophy at UT.
So you just moved there?
And so we moved there, and we're getting ready to do it, and I called. This, I think the listeners will appreciate this.
I know this story.
I called
now.
Scott Oliphant, who was a professor of apologetics at Westminster in Philly, and I told him I was wanting to study some philosophy at UT. And I was expecting him to say, Tipton, it sounds like you've really got your ducks in a row.
Right.
You know Western philosophy. You studied with Bonson, Urego. And he said, do you know Greek? And I said, yes, sir, I do. He said, okay, well, do you know Hebrew? No, you're not ready. And then he said, have you gotten the MDiv or its academic equivalent? I said, no, sir, you're not ready. And then he said, the problem, Tipton, is you're going to make a shipwreck of your faith if you don't go in theologically grounded. So, long story short, after being bludgeoned very lovingly by Dr. Oliphant, we decided to go get our theological training. And so we were only there for a year.
Yeah. But you've been a Longhorn fan for a long time.
Yeah, I have.
Even before that.
Yep.
Well, you know, hopefully we'll be able to return to Austin and have a good conference. We're looking at some topics and once again trying to finalize things. So keep that date open if it seems like a possibility for you. It would probably be just a Saturday event as a regional conference. It won't have all of the particular, you know, scheduling particularities that we have here for our national conference, our annual conference in Grays Lake, but still would be a very solid event and one where we could hopefully meet some new people who are not able to come up to Illinois but might be able to make it down to Austin, April 30th, 2016. So keep updated on, we'll keep you updated on that through the website, through Twitter, and through the programs. So looking forward to that. I think that's all. Let's fire up here at Voss's Biblical Theology. We're continuing on. We've been doing this now for a couple of years, and I always love looking at this book. Anything Voss wrote is spectacular. They're going through, there's a Voss group that just started up at Mid-America, and they're working through the Pauline eschatology now. So we're seeing we're sprouting up Voss groups all over the place, and we always love hearing about that too. Today we're looking at the Passover. You know,
Their tribe increase.
May their tribe increase, indeed. Yeah. And maybe someday we'll get to the Pauline eschatology, but it might be.
I would love that.
I might be retired
2050,
by then.
I think, is the forecasted date.
70 years old, yeah. Mm-hmm. Revelation in the period of Moses, and we've been speaking about a lot of different features of Revelation in this covenant historical era. And we're looking at the names of God. We're looking at the deliverance from sin and from foreign bondage. We've even discussed God's displays of divine omnipotence. And now we are arriving at the Passover, perhaps one of the most significant historical events in Israel's life. You know, that and the passing through the Red Sea, part and parcel of the same event, really. What is the significance, just as we begin, of the Passover, and how does it feature into this redemptive historical era, insofar as Voss describes it?
Well, to relate it to the material we covered last time, it is the way that God's sovereignty and omnipotence are expressed redemptively. Mm-hmm. It's a particular focusing of the sovereignty and omnipotence of God in redeeming a people from a realm of sin and bondage to a realm of righteousness and rest. And so this is going to be critical, and this is just a framing comment here, and we'll talk about it in more detail. But Voss does grant that this Passover has a forensic foundation, as it were, an expiatory sacrifice, which we're about to talk about. But we have to recognize this first and foremost, that the forensic subserves the eschatological. The forensic subserves the aeonic. And what I mean by that is this, that the blood sacrifice and offering is something that effects a realm transition, a transition from a realm of sin and bondage to a realm of righteousness and rest, so that the communion bond with God might be brought to greater intimacy en route to consummation. In other words, Voss is going to remind us once again, as he's done virtually every chapter we've looked at, that the eschatological goal of perfected communion with God, where he gives himself to a holy people in a holy realm, that's what drives the history of special revelation. And the forensic, while indispensable, subserves that more basic redemptive historical, or more broadly, covenant historical movement. And so that's kind of where we're picking up here. And Voss's treatment's very, very helpful.
Yeah, one thing he focuses on heavily is the expiation, the expiatory character here of this sacrifice. But that might seem, maybe a little obvious for some Christians as we're looking at it, but it's a little more complicated than that. He describes how the sacrifice, the Passover sacrifice, might relate to the other Old Testament sacrifices. How would you best classify this particular sacrifice?
Well, the broadest thing to say before we get into just the specific classification of it is he wants to say that the sacrifice has an expiatory strand running through that. And here's what Voss is getting at. This is on the bottom of page 119. He says this, that even though God's grace is sovereign, it cannot be exercised without an accompanying atonement. And what he means by that is this, that the grace of God is something that expresses itself through the satisfaction of divine justice and the removal of sin. There's a distinction we can make in dogmatics between propitiatory sacrifice and expiatory sacrifice. The distinction is basically this, that propitiation involves the removal of divine wrath and placing it upon a substitute. God's wrath is diverted to another. God's wrath is borne by a substitute, and in that way his wrath is satisfied, it's mollified, it's propitiated. Expiation brings into view the removal of sin, the bearing away of sin in terms of both its guilt and its power. What Voss is saying in order to frame the theology of the Passover is that the expression of God's grace requires expiation, the removal of sin and the shedding of blood. And so he looks at this at the language of Passover, and he says it is the name Pasach is derived from the verb that can be translated to leap, to jump over, to spare. Mm-hmm. Camden, do you have a text with you?
Yeah.
I've got a Bible behind me. Would you read Exodus 12:13 and 12:27? Because he said there you can find the what Voss calls the meaning of this verb and the explanation of its etymology, particularly within the text of Exodus,
right.
12:13 and 12:27.
Yeah, 13 says, "The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt." Then verse 27, "You shall say, it is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, for he passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians, but spared our houses. And the people bowed their heads and worshipped."
Yeah, and that's where the language of Passover and the concept of Passover comes from. However, I just want to note this, and I can't help doing this. Just I think our listeners will find it very useful. Would you read Isaiah 31:5? And I'd like to make a comment on the work of Meredith Klein that I think is wonderfully supplemental to Voss.
Yeah, I think the listeners will recognize this. "Like birds hovering, so the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem. He will protect and deliver it. He will spare and rescue it."
Yeah, there, this verb is translated in a way that brings into view avian imagery of a kind of hovering protectorate. And Meredith Klein, back in December of 1994, in a journal of Evangelical Theological Society, JETS, 37:4, pages 497 to 510, he wrote an article entitled "The Feast of Cover Over." And we're not going to give a careful read to that the way we do Voss, or that would take us probably, you know, 2 or 3 months. But just to summarize it so our listeners are aware of this, Klein points out that the avian imagery from Genesis 1-2, the creator spirit hovering over the deep in darkness, and then later in redemptive history, particularly where the Lord hovers over and dwells in the midst of his people, in terms of the Exodus, where he hovers over and protects his people, the language there in Genesis 1-2 and then in Deuteronomy 32, and it's about 10 through 11, but the Lord does what? He hovers over his people as he hovered over the formless world.
It's verse 11 there. Well, mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. And so Klein is arguing that that language of the Lord as an avian shield is a very helpful way to talk about this Passover. It's like a divine covering where when the destroying angel comes and the blood is placed on the threshold entering into the door of the Israelite household, it's as though the Lord through blood hovers over his people, protecting them from the destroying angel, being with his people in blood during the night of judgment, so that when that judgment comes upon Egypt, it is simultaneously a deliverance for the people of God. So Klein is very helpful here, and I find his work very, very persuasive on this point, where what we're getting at in Isaiah 31:5 and other texts is the idea not only of the destroying angel passing over, but the Lord through blood hovering over in terms of an avian protectorate and keeping his people from the judgment of the destroying angel, who is more than likely the angel of the Lord. And it's
much more positive imagery, not in the sense of good versus bad, but it's positive in terms of protecting, not merely the absence of judgment.
Yes.
So it's an even stronger picture of God's deliverance from the danger there in Egypt.
Well, and it coheres so well with the Deuteronomy 32, 10 through 11 text, where the Lord isn't his absence of judgment upon his people, but it's his presence and mercy that is with them in avian form. Klein discerns that as something that, if not present, his people would most certainly be consumed. So it's a very helpful point. Now, in light of that, and I just would turn our listeners to that and say, read the Feast of the Cover Over from Jets, 37:4, December 1994, pages 497 to 510. Very helpful. That raises an interesting question, and this is, I think, something our listeners will find surprising. There have been people, Protestants, who have wanted to deny the sacrificial character of the blood that is shed at Passover. And you ask the question, what is the significance of the blood, and to what kind of sacrifice does it belong? I think we could say this, that it's wrong. I've heard sermons this way where people say the blood put on the house was like a badge that identified Israelites and distinguished them from Egyptians. It's almost like, hey, leave the light on in the bedroom and I'll know you're home. Leave the light on in the living room, I'll know you're home, and I can identify that you're in the house. That sort of thing's like a marker.
Well, there is a covenantal marking significance, but it's much more than that.
There you go. Yeah. It is that, but it's not only or even most basically that. He says there is an efficacy to the blood. And that's where on the top of page 120, he says the blood that was put on the houses was not a mere signal, although it was a signal, by which the dwellings of the Hebrews could be recognized. It may have been this too, but its real efficacy was derived from its sacrificial character. And here, Voss quotes Exodus 12:27, where he says, "It is the sacrifice of Jehovah's Passover who passed over the houses of the children in Egypt." And now, Camden, I'd like our listeners to look at two texts that Voss cites here. Right after that, Exodus 34:25, and I've grabbed a little text here so I can read something too. But if our listeners would look at Exodus 34:25, and then Camden, you can read 1 Corinthians 5:7. That'll save us time. I'll read the Exodus 34:25. You can read the 1 Corinthians 5:7, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Exodus 34:25 says this. It says, "You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, or let the sacrifice of the feast of Passover remain until the morning." The point here is in verse 25, and this is going to be critical, the Passover feast involves a sacrifice, a blood sacrifice. And then first Corinthians 5:7.
Yeah. "Cleanse out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you really are unleavened. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed."
Yeah. Now, here's what I'm wanting to get at, that there was an efficacy of sacrificial significance, or a sacrificial efficacy to the blood that was shed. And what that means is this, that not only is there a a blood sacrifice by which death and destruction and judgment are averted, so that the judgment that is coming upon Egypt does not befall the Israelites. In other words, not only is there a forensic dimension to this sacrifice, but there is also an efficacy of realm transfer that's built into the sacrifice. And what I mean by that is that as the destroying angel comes and brings judgment upon the Egyptian households, it is by that means and in terms of that divine presence shielding Israel from the judgment that Israel is liberated from the realm of sin and bondage and brought into through the waters of the Red Sea, through the Lord's presence hovering over his people, as it were, that they are brought into the land of righteousness and rest. And so the significance then, both from Exodus 34:25 and 1 Corinthians 5:7, is that there is an efficacy to this sacrifice. In fact, 1 Corinthians 5:7 interprets the work of Christ in terms of a sacrifice that is put in the context of an eschatological Passover event, right? And then in 1 Corinthians 5:7, and in terms of the theology of the New Testament, what does the sacrifice of Jesus do? And this is something I think our listeners really need to get a handle on. Not only does that sacrifice propitiate wrath and expiate sin, but it transfers from this present evil age. The sacrifice of Christ becomes a foundation for transitioning a people out of the present evil age. In fact, Paul in Galatians 1:4, expanding now on this theology from 1 Corinthians 5:7, he says this: grace and peace to you from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ, who gave himself for our sins to deliver us from the present evil age according to the will of our God and Father. So that the sacrifice of Christ not only delivers from the guilt and power of sin, but it delivers from the present evil age. And just as there was a realm transfer by the shedding of typical blood in the Passover event, a movement from sin and bondage to righteousness and rest and life, so likewise from the lesser to the greater in the sacrifice of Christ, our Paschal Lamb. It is his sacrifice that not only forgives sin and liberates from its enslaving power, but even more basically, it when conjoined to the efficacy of his resurrection ascension, it is the means by which we are transferred from this present evil age and made partakers of the righteousness and life of the age to come. And what that does is it situates the forensic as critical, but not the central concern. The forensic is a means to an eschatological end, it is a means toward a realm transfer. And I think it's what makes me so sad when Voss says that there are some within the Protestant tradition who have in fact, Camden, did it surprise you? I know we've read this several times before, but did it surprise you that just in reaction to Roman Catholic theology, some Protestants would deny the sacrificial character, especially in light of Exodus 34:25 and 1 Corinthians 5:7? Yeah, I don't know how you can do it.
It's pretty ridiculous. But it does show, if you have a reactionary mindset and position where you develop your theology in response to error or in response to other people rather than a constructive theology that's based upon the exegesis, the careful exegesis of texts. You know, think of the very first chapter of Voss's book here where he lays out a taxonomy of the different disciplines and where biblical theology falls in line along with systematic theology and how both derive themselves or are based upon the foundation of exegetical theology. This is exactly an example of somebody who's not engaging in exegetical theology. And you end up in all sorts of conundrums and theological problems because of the Roman Catholic view and the theology of the Mass has a certain understanding of the sacrifice of Christ. They would say that the Passover lamb was a typal sacrifice as well, looking forward to the once-for-all sacrifice of Christ. But then they also have this notion of a representation of the sacrifice of Christ over and over again every time the Mass is celebrated. Mm. So it's not precisely accurate to say that the Roman Catholic view is that Christ is re-sacrificed, although they do say represented or re-presented. In some ways might be a distinction without much of a difference.
Yeah. You know, and just dawned on me, Camden, when you were mentioning that, I think both Voss and Klein, when both of them are insisting on the expiatory character of the blood, and when Klein further advances the idea that the Lord is present in that blood, with that blood, shielding his people, it gives even greater beauty to the sacrifice dimension of what's happening at the Passover, and helps us see how it is that not only does the sacrifice address sin, but because the Lord is present in that blood with his people, he is the one delivering them from judgment and out of the realm of sin and bondage. So look at, just think of what you miss. Mm-hmm. If you get reactionary, and we've seen this before, there's no reason to detail things, but it's very easy to let reaction kind of guide your theological formulation. And this is a wonderful reminder: stay with the biblical text.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll see you next time when we look at the Bereath, the covenant made between the Lord and Israel. And he speaks again about viewing the blood as expiatory versus viewing the blood merely as something which affects sacramental union in the sense like, well, we all ate from this sacrifice and we were all covered with the blood over our doorpost, and that unites us together into a people group. And since the Lord told us to do this, we're now bound to him, and that blood is a symbol. That's not false, but it's not sufficient. It's for the reality here, because there is an actual payment made. It's a type of sacrifice because it looks forward to the blood of Christ, which is necessary. So, the blood of bulls and goats is not sufficient or powerful enough to atone for sins. We needed the blood of the God-man. Yet at the same time, if we look at the Westminster Standards, which I think rightly teach, I believe in 7.5 and 8.6 of the Confession of Faith, I might be mistaken, but those sections discuss the very nature of even these Old Testament types and sacrifices, that this really is a means of grace, and the Lord is mediating to his people the once-for-all shed blood of Christ even before that blood is yet to be shed.
Amen.
But there is a real sacrifice, and there is a real atonement for the one who would partake of this meal, of this ceremony, and of the sacrifice by faith. Yet there would even be those that would partake and be spared from the judgment of water through the Red Sea, but yet one day, fall away. And but for the one who partakes by faith, he will be brought unto the troop, not just the typical promised land, but the ultimate, final, consummate promised land.
So another way to put it, Camden, is if you let the true expiatory sacrificial character of this go, you really lose the gospel
in terms of
it being applied in the life experience of the believers, and this becomes a mere empty shell. Right? The Exodus would then just be a kind of
then you don't even need it to be
shell.
Historical. And that's another problem with the critics, who deny whether this actually happened. There's always a critic somewhere, Valhausian or otherwise, that this really didn't happen. And it's not important that it happened, but we can still learn lessons from looking back upon whoever wrote this after the fact.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's so important for us to remember that there is a strong sense in which controversy is a necessary feature for the church to preserve the integrity of its doctrine. The critics are always going to try to find one way or another a naturalizing explanation for this. But, Camden, when it comes to the question of the nature of that sacrifice in terms of its original Old Testament context, Voss said something I think our readers would probably find very interesting. It is not a sin offering. Leviticus 1 and 2 profiles the nature of various offerings under the Levitical order. And he says that it's not a sin offering, even though it has an expiatory elephant element. Not an elephant, an expiatory element.
That would be something where the Israelites would come up. Maybe the Queen of Sheba would bring some day so they could sacrifice.
You got to cut that.
Expiatory elephant. Oh, I'm not cutting that one. Yeah.
Okay. No, we've got to. So there is an expiatory element, but that does not make it a sin offering. And he says, because the offerer was not allowed to eat a sin offering. And so Voss says, the closest. His point is this. I'll just let our listeners know. His point is that you can't reduce the Passover sacrifice to any specific sacrifice given under the Levitical order because it bears a unique character. But he said if you were going to try to get to its essence, he said it would be close to a peace offering.
Yes.
And now here's what's so interesting about this. He says the idea prominent in every peace offering was that of berit fellowship, a covenant fellowship with God. The meal was an exponent of the state of peace and blessedness enjoyed. And so here's what's so interesting. The actual eating of the meal in light of the sacrifice that is given moves you in the direction of the consequence of the sacrifice resulting in fellowship with God. And think of it, this keeps the focus where it belongs, on God conferring himself upon a holy people in a holy realm through blood, through an obedient act of sacrifice by which the communion bond with God is brought to its fruition, at least here in its typical provisional Mosaic form. And so Voss is saying it's precisely because this meal followed the sacrifice proper, we have to recognize the need for expiation. Mm-hmm. But here's Voss's point. And Camden, I can't ever get tired of saying this, and I hope our listeners will appreciate this. Expiation is not an end in itself.
Mm-hmm.
The forensic is not an end in itself. The center of the gospel is not forensic per se. It is not justification per se. The center of the gospel is spirit-forged union with the Messiah and the consummation of the communion bond with God in him. Mm-hmm. That's what the gospel is all about. So where does the forensic fit? It is the means to the end of perfecting that communion bond with God through the Messiah, by the Spirit and through faith.
Yeah.
And so I really appreciate Voss pointing this out. Yes, there is slaying. Yes, there's manipulation of blood and there's expiation. But that expiation is unto a realm transfer, both in the Old and New Covenants.
That's true. And there's also another element of another means that allows for that realm transfer. I think what we see that here at the bottom, close to the bottom of 120 with the symbolism of the hyssop, because there's the application of this blood to be made by a bunch of hyssop. And he says hyssop figures everywhere as an instrument of purification. So there is an expiation, and that expiation does purify us in one sense, legally taking our sins away. But we can also consider purification in a more sanctified sense, not just as realm transfer, but as the beginning of a process of being made holy, a renovative process even.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that hyssop features into the sacramental symbolism of Israel for ages and ages. And he continues that on too to discuss how the memory of this redemption is brought to the fore as this meal is celebrated time and time again, but also the bitter herbs, where they are to remember the bitterness and the life in Israel and then the redemption and liberation they had from that plight. It's a constant reminder of their need of salvation and then looking at that broadly and then narrowing in or zooming in to see the aspects that afford for that salvation would be the expiation and propitiation, the forensic elements, and also the need for sanctification, not just in name only, but also a renovation to be made holy and pure. And if we want to add and round out our Ordo Salutis, we also consider our adoption and our acceptance, the solution to the problem of our alienation. All of those things feed in, and then the overarching process and the terminus of glorification demonstrates how we're moving. This is a pilgrim people. They didn't celebrate this Passover once, and then it's over and done with, and all of a sudden, immediately after eating it, they're in Canaan. And neither, even when they ended up in Canaan, did they say, well, we're here and it's all over and done with. The faithful would see that that this was not the ultimate, and that they had this ultimate need to be with the Lord in consummate presence, and that would not yet come until the Lord returns, but until the finality of Messiah's work and the Spirit's work is done in their lives. And that doesn't happen until, well, we're still waiting for it. Till the Lord comes back.
Well, and that's what I think down at the bottom of the page, that's why Voss says the Passover feast, the Passover sacrifice, the Paschal Lamb is unique from the more individual guilt offering, sin offering, peace offering. And he says, I love the way he says it, that this Passover had and retained its historical background.
Exactly.
The bitterness of the herbs reminded of the bitterness of Egyptian bondage, but it had a distinctively national dimension to it. And what I like about
A distinction is from circumcision.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It reminds you that's why the Passover is a sign of the progress or progressive character of redemptive revelation. That now the promises that are associated with circumcision in the typical realm are coming to a kind of penultimate or provisional fulfillment as the people as a whole, united to the Messiah, are experiencing all of the benefits you mentioned in the context of deliverance out of Egypt and into a realm and a land that is flowing with milk and honey. And it gives it this corporate and redemptive historical significance, gives it a kind of, how can we say this? It's a movement forward in the history of redemption, advancing beyond the Abrahamic and telling us that one greater than Moses, one greater than the blood that was shed in the Passover lamb, one greater than this is coming, who is going to perfect and consummate this Exodus movement. It's there that we start to see the push toward what we saw in 1 Corinthians 5:7, that Christ, our Paschal Lamb, has been sacrificed, and in him, what happens? We are justified, sanctified, adopted. We are already in the process of being glorified, and we have been translated out of this present evil age and into the age to come by the Spirit already. As we wait. So it really is. This is just a wonderful redemptive, historically robust section in biblical theology, which I hope our listeners can really reflect on this for some time. That's why we spend, I know it's probably becoming a running joke, but that's why we try to take as much time as we can to do this justice, because it is worth it. It really is.
I'm so looking forward to looking at the next section, beginning on page 121 with the Bereith. I spirantize my Tavs here, as I was taught.
I know you don't,
because you weren't taught by the same people.
Okay.
Not making a value judgment.
Better.
No Dagesh there, but not making a judgment. The Bereith made between Jehovah, the name that doesn't exist, we like Yahweh, between Yahweh and Israel. And that's going to be rich. And when you think of how even the covenant notion develops in this particular redemptive historical era, It's going to be really great in March. So we're looking forward to coming back and discussing these things. Until then, you can follow up with all of our Voss Group episodes at reformedforum.org/Voss, V-O-S. And you can also get a hold of us by sending us an email at mail@reformedforum.org. You can tweet us at Reformed Forum. Once again, for the time being, we're looking at April 30th, 2016. If you have any realm of possibility of coming to Austin, Texas, to the Austin area for a conference, try to keep that date open. And we would love to see you if everything goes according to the developing plans. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.